Hi there, welcome to the Keto Happiness Podcast. I'm Rob Saunders and we're recorded from the sunny heart of North Wales in the UK. I started my keto journey in March 2018. Had some great results for some challenges. You'll get to know me and a little bit more in these podcasts. Now, works for me, may not work for you. But if you are embarking on a new way of eating, a new diet, new fitness regime, or even any change at all, please consult your doctor or health practitioner. You can find Keto Happiness at ketohappiness.co.uk. We're available on all the streaming media, and we have social accounts on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. I hope you enjoy these podcasts as much as I do. And on with today's show. Hi, and welcome to episode 23 of the Keto Happiness Podcast. Today's guest is back again. He's Dr. David G. Harper, Dave Harper, who joins us all the way from Canada. And a little bit about David. He's a health educator and cancer researcher. Dr. David G. Harper has studied the impact of diet on human health for many years. The culmination of that extensive work is the Biot Diet, a ketogenic food regime that he and his wife began in 2012. The significant weight loss and health improvement they experienced led Dave Harper to counsel hundreds of people on the Biot Diet with similar consistent and impressive results. Now, David is an associate professor of kinesiology at the University of Fraser Valley and a visiting scientist at the British Columbia Cancer Research Centre, Terry Fox Laboratory. He holds a PhD from the University of British Columbia and has completed a postdoctoral fellowship in comparative psychology at the University of Cambridge. He's on the scientific advisory board of the Canadian Clinicians for Therapeutic Nutrition and is a member of the Institute of Personalised Therapeutic Nutrition. Dave came on last time about talking about the Biot Diet book, which we'll go into later on. But I should make you aware, guys, that we're recording this on the 18th of March 2020. We're in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, so this should be noted that Dave will be talking about that as well and his recent visit to a low-carb Denver. We'll be back for you very shortly. And a very warm welcome to Dr. David Harper. Hi, Dave.
Hi. How are you doing, Rob? It's nice to be on the show again, and nice to see your face this time. Last time we just did it by audio. So I know.
Wonders of modern science.
Like the rest of the planet.
Yeah. So obviously we'll talk about the Biot Diet and what's been happening with that later on. But I did mention at the start of the show that this is a time where the world is in a little bit of uneasiness and turmoil. It's the 18th of March 2020, and we've been hit by a pandemic of COVID-19 or the coronavirus. And I just thought I'd start with just how you're feeling, how your country's helping, and even your jurisdiction where you are in British Columbia.
Sure, thanks, Rob. I'm feeling just fine, thank you. We'll see what happens in the coming days. I returned from the Low Carb Denver conference, put on by Rod Taylor and Dr. Jeffrey Gerber in Denver. And I, you know, just sort of snuck out on Sunday before the borders have closed down here now for personal travel. And really, it's just for movement of goods now. So like European countries and so on, in Canada, now we're hunkered down. We have about 600 cases throughout the country.
Sure.
So, you know, it's a small number now, but of course it's the exponential rate of growth that concerns all of us, and that number will grow. And as that does, we've had, 7 deaths, I think, but that will grow as well, sadly.
Yeah.
People are, you know, I'm in a period of a 14-day period of what we call self-isolation. So I'm at home. I'm not interacting with anybody else but my wife who lives here.
Sure.
You know, I'm not going out and mixing with anybody in public. So I'm doing a lot of this, a lot of chatting with people on, you know, video conferencing. Get my work done. I'm a university professor, so my courses were all online anyway, so there's very little to change there. So, you know, all things considered, my life, Rob, is very safe and comfortable right now, but I really feel for those people out there, especially people who are living on the margins.
Yeah.
You know, who are very much at risk for this, because they probably have multiple comorbidities, which would make them more susceptible to the virus. The virus, by the way, is called SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah.
Which is a variant of the SARS-CoV, which was, you know, 15 years ago. And that, Vancouver was one of the places affected. Vancouver and Toronto had a number of deaths. So we're actually, you know, our Centers for Disease Control here and so on, we're pretty up on SARS, because we have public health here and a sensible government, we're pretty good at responding. And everybody can look back anywhere and say, in hindsight, now that things have broken out, oh, you should have done more earlier. But you know, when you do these things like closing borders, they've basically told everybody to stay home.
Yep.
So nobody's going to work except those that have to. It's very, very quiet out there. It's a beautiful, beautiful day, and I live in a beautiful, beautiful place. So it's nice to look out the window. But I think the general sense, and I'm sure the Welsh are very much like Canadians, is we do just, you know, stay calm and press on. But we also, we turn to our better selves and we cooperate with one another.
Yep.
You know, people are hoarding, but most people aren't. It's amazing how many little organizations have popped up to help, you know, seniors get their medicine and get their food, and lots of people are volunteering to do that. So I'm actually kind of heartwarmed by the response now. You know, a week ago, I think, you know, we kind of under responded, and that was, you know, people were taking it a little bit too lightly, I think. And you know, I'm a biologist, I should mention. I think we talked about that on the show before. I'm a biology, my PhD is in biology. And I do teach health courses as well. So this is one of the things that I teach people is about, you know, what epidemics and pandemics are and how infectious disease works. And I do, you know, I'm not an immunologist, but I do work with an immunology team. We do the immunohistochemistry at the BC Cancer Research Center, Terry Fox Lab. I work there with esteemed scientist, Dr. Gerald Crystal. So I can talk about some of the research we've done on immunology and how diet affects that.
Oh, brilliant. Because the first question I was going to ask really is, how does it attack autoimmune? Mainly on a personal level, my son Jack, he's 18. He was diagnosed last year with Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And obviously it's an autoimmune condition. And obviously we're quite worried, but we're quite lucky that he's taken on board how we eat and some of the things that we take as well that's combated that. And I was just going to ask, how does this virus attack the autoimmune? And do people like Jack have anything to do just to be precautious?
Excellent question. You know, I wish Jack the best. I think, you know, that doesn't specifically affect the respiratory system, which is key. But, you know, of course, because Hashimoto's tends to, you know, lower the thyroid and so on, it tends to lower metabolism everywhere. So that's an autoimmune thing. So that's sort of an excessive response of the immune system rather than an under response like immune suppression. So let's start at the beginning though, with viruses. So viruses are these things, they're not like bacteria, for instance. There are many, you know, where we debate in biology whether they're living or not. They're really just, you know, an RNA or DNA strand wrapped around with a protein coat, and then sometimes a lipid coat like this one has. Mm-hmm. And then they have little receptors on them, and they you know, bind to cells, and they get into those cells, and they sort of hijack the cell's replication machinery to make more copies of themselves. And that's really all they do. And then they spread to other cells and make more copies and spread to other. And often when they do that, they damage the cells that they're invading. So the other thing that most people I don't think realize is there are almost no virus-free cells in on the planet. All prokaryotic cells, which are the more modern cells, are infected with viruses of different types. Most of them do nothing to us. And that's why they survive, is they don't have it. They have a benign effect, because, of course, if you're a virus, you don't want to kill your host, because then you go with it.
Yeah.
So then there are these pathogenic viruses, and these typically are viruses that either mutate within humans, so they change their genetic code so they do cause disease, or they jump from species to species. So in the case of all of these coronaviruses, and by the way, there are some coronaviruses, there are four different groups, which just give you a cold. So about 20% of colds have, so, a lot of us have had coronavirus, but it's just a milder version of it.
Sure.
But then there are these ones that cause SARS, which is severe acute respiratory syndrome. So there was the SARS 15 years ago or so. There was the MERS, which was in the Middle East. And then this is a new one, a variant of the first SARS. And so there's two things. One is, from an individual perspective, if you haven't been exposed to a virus in the past, and you do get exposed to one, that virus is going to go about its business replicating whether it's going to kill you or not, because it doesn't know that. And it's your immune system's job to try and protect you from that. And the immune system has really, you know, three phases. One, there's surface barriers like your skin and your mucous membranes and so on. Then the second is what we call the innate immune system, which protects us against everything. It's not specific to a particular bacteria or virus. And then the third level is this unbelievably wonderful biotech lab in your body called the acute immune system, which produces antibodies and killer T cells and so on, which can actually identify virally infected cells, cancer-infected cells, and it specifically attacks those and kills them. So that's what keeps us all alive. We would, if we didn't have, as we've seen with HIV and so on, if you don't have an effective immune system, then you're susceptible to these. So the reason that this is such a concern is twofold. One is because it's new. It seems to have jumped from bats. And so it's new to the human species. And so nobody that we know of anyway has any innate immunity to it. So it's going to infect anybody it comes in contact with. And then it's just up to your body to try and defend against that attack. And through that, the first one to react is the innate immune system, which involves macrophages and other cell mechanisms. And then, if that can't fend it off, then the adaptive immune system comes in and creates these antibodies and cleans it up, and then we're well again. And for most people, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But the trick there is the adaptive immune system takes a few days to start working. It doesn't start right away. The innate immune system is instant. So often what happens is, it's got a few days for that viral to get in there and start replicating, and that's when we feel sick. So, so what we want to do here, most of us, have nothing to fear from this virus itself. If it does infect you, it will most likely just give you something like a cold or maybe a flu.
Yep.
The thing is, if you are immune compromised, have respiratory issues, if you have cardiometabolic syndrome, any of those comorbidities, those are the people who are at high risk. And yeah. Those are the people that unfortunately are passing away. So what we need to do is create a situation where we don't infect the people that are at risk. And the way to do that, even though we might not get that sick, is to make sure that they don't get sick.
Sure.
Yeah. And the way to do that is, one, protect yourself from getting it by isolating yourself in this social distancing. And then two, doing the best we can to make sure that it doesn't get into things like seniors' homes and hospitals where people can be affected. So that's kind of the long and short of it. So I'll go back, and I'm not sure if that exactly answered the question, but there's another story, but I'll breathe. Go ahead and ask your next question.
Yeah, sure. And it was, it's important over here. Now things are being given to us by the UK government as well. And they're stepping it up. And at the time of this podcast, it's just been announced that schools close in a couple of days. Exams are finished, which then the social isolation will start. But the government had a different tack to a few countries, and I'd like to hear your view about the herd immunity theory that they started off, and I think they were mainly to stop our health service being too overloaded. Now, I don't know what it is over in Canada, but it was to create, there was a graph that's been put out in every newspaper over here that rather than a big spike, it's more like a small sombrero in terms of how the actual virus starts. Rather than everybody get it, you know, initially, it was more of, yeah, let's let people get it that are healthy, but keep them self-isolated, and this will then technically give less pressure of people needing hospital beds and ICUs and things like that. I just wondered what your take is on that, on the sort of the herd immunity theory.
Yeah, well, and I saw the Aussies are talking about that a little bit too, but. Yeah. And I'm not a public health professional, but I can tell you what I think of it. I think that's probably would backfire.
Yeah, that's what we thought. And, you know, personally. And
the reason is that people, we don't know that much about this virus yet, but we do know now that it can be passed on before you have any symptoms. So even if you had it and got tested, you might even show negative because you don't have any symptoms. Mm-hmm. There may be an argument that actually younger people are getting it and passing it on without getting that sick themselves or even knowing it.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's good to have herd immunity, but the best way, of course, for herd immunity is to use vaccinations. And we don't have a vaccine for this yet.
Yeah.
There are some in development. They'll probably be rushed. If you want to wager a glass of wine on this, Rob, I would say Canada might lead the way on this one because we already have some labs that were working on SARS and the receptor that the virus uses to get into the epithelial cells is called the ACE2 receptor. That's the angiotensin converting enzyme, the one that Ramipril works on to control blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And so there are some companies here that are all ramped up and already trying to produce a vaccine, but that's still going to be, you know, probably, I mean, they'll test them soon, but it'll be at least a year before that's available.
Sure.
That's why you should get your flu shot every year, because that creates that herd immunity, which just means there's, you know, if you come in contact with four people, maybe three of them have had the vaccine and won't be infected, right?
Sure.
And the other end of it is treatment. So what can we do in terms of treatments when somebody does have it? And again, it's very early days for that. They'll come up with some things that might help mitigate it. But right now, the treatment is you sit at home and hopefully get better. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, and you run into respiratory distress, then you need to go to the hospital and they can give you some drugs that help with that. And then if they don't work, then you go on a respirator and hopefully your lungs recover. And if they don't, sadly, you pass away. But I don't think the average person should be concerned about that. I think the notion of trying to create this herd immunity by letting people get it and encouraging them to give it to each other, all that's going to do is create that peak. So the curve you're talking about is the number of active cases at any point in time.
Yeah.
So right now what's happening in a lot of places, like that happened in Italy and so on, is the curve is so steep, it surpasses the capacity of the healthcare system to look after those people that need hospitalization and respirators. And that lasts for a while. And then you're in big, big trouble like they are in Italy, where people are, you know, they can't treat them. And that's going to happen in the United States. I think it's already happening in New York and elsewhere because they're just not prepared. We can talk about what's happening in the United States because I was just there observing it in a while. I think herd immunity is a good thing to have, but the way to do it is through vaccination, and we can't do that now. So now what we'd want to do, it's a mathematical problem, really. It's how many people that are infected infect other people. Mm-hmm. And if that number is two or greater, so I get infected, I infect two people, they infect two people, then you get this exponential growth of the disease. And as more people get infected, more people are going to be hospitalized and going to die. So it's the rate at which that doubling occurs. And the way you slow that down is you drive that down closer to one. So if you get it to one, where one person infects the second person, then we can flatten that curve and broaden it. So maybe the whole population gets exposed and maybe a third to two-thirds of the population gets infected. But it's over a much longer period of time that doesn't surpass the capacity of the healthcare system to treat those people that need treatment.
Sure.
That's the math.
And back to the... again, I'm going to bring in the diet and obviously the some of the people that are listening to this podcast may have blood pressure issues. They may have diabetes, whether it be type 2 or type 1. And you just mentioned that people that were on blood pressure tablets and medication, you know, they should be slightly worried. The question I got from, actually, it was my wife, Sian. She was asking, there's some things in the news about anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, and how that, we've been told, you know, people with certain conditions shouldn't take that. They should take something like paracetamol, which helps the fever. But I just wondered if you'd clarify on a medical side why we're not told to take anti-inflammatories.
Again, you know, I'm not a physician either. I'm just a lowly researcher and teacher. But I think what you have to remember is, again, the way that we're going to beat this is our own immune system. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be through some kind of because it's just happened too quickly. We don't have time for the, you know, development and production of these pharmaceuticals. So there'll be lots of information about there about, you know, vitamin C or this or that that can help you prevent it. So if I can address the first point, the hypertension, which is high mm-hmm. blood pressure. Yeah. And so if you look at the, and I really, you know, you said people are worried. I wish people wouldn't worry, but I want them to be cautious. Because the worrying just creates anxiety, and anxiety suppresses your immune system. So mm-hmm. we have to, even if we're going to joke about this a little bit, Rob, we have to keep doing the things that make humans happy, which is, you know, humor, art, music, going about your life as best you can. You know, but now we're this period of social isolation, so have fun with what you can do at home. You know, my wife went out and bought a puzzle yesterday. Right?
So amazing.
I haven't done a puzzle since I was a kid. But
we've tasked the boys. Like Jack's, as you know, is an aspiring filmmaker, so he's going to be editing and doing some sort of a video blog and other things. My younger son Ted, who is an artist and also a musician, we've tasked him to learn the guitar because he's just learnt the ukulele. And we'll be working, but we, myself and Sean, love doing yoga. And our yogi has started doing online live Facebook feeds for donations. And one of the best things that I've been, practicing every night before I go to bed, because I'm anxious what's happening, breathing techniques just to, you know, steady the body, get all that oxygen inside the cells.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's a breathing thing. So when you're anxious, you don't breathe properly either. Mm-hmm. So yoga is great for that. Yeah. So let's go back to these. I sent you a PowerPoint deck. I just sent it before we went on air. I don't know if you have that handy. If you do, there's a couple of slides in there now. So this is some of the data I was presenting. I was actually asked to sub in at the Low Carb Denver conference over the last weekend. And so I was really presenting on how ketogenic diets can help prevent and treat cancer, which is my area of research, but other chronic disease. But I also wanted to introduce that quite knowledgeable audience, mostly physicians, to the any evidence that diet or ketogenic diet could help with this present COVID. So if we start with there's a slide in there that shows a Chinese study based on the present outbreak. So this is with the COVID-19.
Yeah.
And this is also supported by data coming from Italy. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's mostly anecdotal, but so the people that that succumb to this virus are generally people who are not well. So they, for starters, they're older. Not always, but typically older, and that's because older people, you know, it's kind of like how much hardiness is left in your tank. So as you mm-hmm. age, you know, that window of hardiness that protects you from any illness, that tank gets kind of drained down. And the closer you are to zero, the more something like this opportunistic virus can affect you negatively. So the conditions that seem to be evident in those that succumb to the disease are cardiometabolic disorders. So mm-hmm. that would include primarily hypertension, high blood pressure, as you mentioned.
Yep.
which indicates a systemic inflammation and, you know, blocking of the arteries and so on, perhaps. Yeah. Second, any kind of cardiomyopathy, any disease that prevents the heart function. People with compromised lungs, even heavy smokers. And then diabetics. And so those are called morbidities. They're things that make people sick. And when you have more than one, they're called comorbidities. Yeah. And so if you have one morbidity, you know, your likelihood at any age of succumbing doubles. And then if you have two, it goes up more. And if you have three, it goes up more. So people with the people that don't do well are people with three or more comorbidities. So they may have diabetes and high blood pressure and some cardiovascular disease. So these are not well people. Now, you know, if you look at the state of the United States, you know, 60% of Americans have one of those morbidities. These are American adults, and 40% have two of them. So that's not a healthy population. You can see it because it's you notice this also in obesity, which is a disease that is also a comorbidity as well. So they've got a big problem down there. Is they have a population that's been trying to control what we call metabolic syndrome. So metabolic syndrome is a combination of high blood pressure, dyslipidemia, so their lipids are off, and then they can't control their blood sugar, so they have diabetes as well. So that's one side of it. So if you want to optimize your chance of not getting this, stay away from people. If you do get it, you're much more likely to have a good outcome if you're healthier. It helps to be younger, but we can't do anything about that. But we can sure make ourselves healthier. And, you know, there's studies after study about, you know, the burden of global burden of chronic disease, and the food you eat seems to be more important than anything else, even exercise. But sleep is important. And of course, in this case, hygiene is important. So washing your hands all the time is good. So if we look at diet, you know, the great thing about the ketogenic diet, you know, this is the key to happiness, keto happiness, key to happiness podcast. So let's talk about that for a little bit. And this is part of what
I'm just on the slide, which says, can ketogenic diet confer resistance to COVID-19? Maybe. And
that's the last slide. So that's the answer. And so the short answer is maybe. And the answer is we don't have really a clue right now. But what we can do, and this is what I like to do with my students as an educator. Again, I'm not a physician. I'm not a public health officer. I'm just a researcher. But we can look at the evidence. So if you look at the fact that people that are succumbing to this disease are those with cardiometabolic syndrome, with diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure and so on, I think there's little doubt that for most people, ketogenic diets are not for everyone, but for most people, the best way to address those is through a ketogenic diet. Because removing carbohydrate from the diet has been demonstrated, I believe, in good, robust science to reduce obesity, to reduce insulin resistance, and to reduce inflammation. And those three things, I call them the axis of illness. We talked about this, I think, last time on the podcast. So those three things make each other worse: obesity, insulin resistance, which is about blood sugar, and inflammation. And if you pour high carb diet on that, that'll accelerate that. And I think that's the root cause of most chronic disease, including cancer, in the Western world today, is this emphasis we put on high carb, crappy diets with lots of processed foods, and high sugar. So the good news is that if you work that backwards, take sugar out of your diet, take those high glycemic index starches out of your diet, and I feel there's a therapeutic benefit to a ketogenic diet, that you can do the best thing in terms of lifestyle to address cardiometabolic disease. And it's not too late for most people to start that now. Secondly, the other slides there. Now here's the science. So
I will post these up, if you don't mind me, on social media, if that's okay with you, Dave.
Sure. Yeah. And it will be up, by the way. The video of my presentation will be up on Diet Doctor soon, and then it's on there for a couple of months because they provided the live feed for us, and then it's going to be on Low Carb too, so those sites will be available, and I'll be posting that on my social media, so you can get a hold of me at just biodiet.org is our site. And I'll post there. And also, I think on Facebook, I'm Dave Harper, and on LinkedIn, I'm David G. Harper. And you can friend me there if you're listening, and I'll and then you can follow along.
Amazing.
So that's the strongest bit of evidence for ketogenic diet is it is the most effective lifestyle change you can make to address cardiometabolic syndrome. The second evidence. Now, here's where we go to infectious diseases. How long have you been keto adapted, Rob?
Well, it's been 2 years and 8 days.
Okay. Yeah. And how many minutes?
Yeah. I had a ketoversary on the 10th of March.
And, okay. I was going to say, is this some sort of your last pint of Guinness? You can remember that far back.
It was that last pint of Guinness. Yeah. And I know exactly where I was. I was in Dublin. So.
Oh, that's charming. And so let me ask you, how many flus and colds have you had since?
I can't think of I've had any actually, I don't think I've been ill apart from, tearing a muscle just doing exercise, but that was just me being silly and overdoing it.
Yeah. So, this is the anecdotal evidence, and it's anecdotal, which means we don't have any science to back this up. But this is what I hear all the time. I've been keto forever and I just don't get sick anymore.
Sure.
I shouldn't say forever. I've been keto for X number of years and I don't get sick anymore. I've been keto now for 8 years. I think I've probably just been exposed to COVID-19 through my travels in the United States. So that's why I'm self-isolating.
Yeah, sure.
So far, so good. But I just don't get those things. And so the good thing about working at a, you know, immunohistochemistry lab is we can actually test our blood and see what it looks like. But So we'll come to that test in a moment. But so when I was at this conference, and this conference were mostly people, you know, who were very into, they're most of the physicians, mostly family practice physicians, who are very interested in the therapeutic benefits. So I asked them, how many people have been keto adapted for 2 years or more? And I'd say it was 2/3 of the audience. And I said, well, how many of you have had a flu or a cold in that time? And this is just my visual observation, but again, 2/3 of the audience, and it looked like the same people to me. And then I said, well, how many felt like they were coming down with something, got that chills, headache, that sort of thing, thought, oh, I better cancel all my appointments the next day. And then they wake up and they feel fine. And again, 2/3 of the audience. So everybody's experiencing that same thing. And this is not science. This is anecdote.
Yeah,
but
here
we're talking about, you know, a couple hundred people or 150 people or so answering that question. So that is a question. Does a ketogenic diet confer some immune advantage? And I think there's now starting to be some evidence that it does. So let's now look at it in terms of upper respiratory diseases, which would include colds and flus. Mm-hmm. And so there was a study recently, it was in November, by a group from Yale. And this was a study looking at keto-adapted mice. So we're talking about mice, not humans. So it has no meaning for humans, but they're looking for a mechanism.
Yeah.
And they used actually a H1N1 virus, which is an influenza virus, and that's like the Spanish flu virus. And the mice, of course, were genetically identical. And essentially, when you give the mice on the regular mice chow, the H1N1 virus, they all die.
Yeah.
And they'll die of a respiratory disease. Mm-hmm. So then they keto adapted a group, the experimental group. And they had a very high rate of survival. In fact, I don't have the numbers in front of me there, but you might have them, but they have a very high rate of survival. And they went on to test whether you could just, you know, take ketones orally, you know, like those oral ketone salts or you know, MCT oil or something like that, or whether, you know, adding ketones to their blood made a difference. And it seems that they needed to be keto adapted. Mm-hmm. So hold on to that idea. So there is some notion that a ketogenic diet helps mice prevent themselves from getting a deadly influenza virus, which is a respiratory virus. And it's probably through some innate response, not the adaptive response. So it's preventing the virus from getting into the cells. And they think it has to do with the change of the outer surface of the cells. That's mm-hmm. their conclusion. And if you're posting those, people will see that reference there.
Sure.
So that's one piece of evidence. Now, the second one is, and this came out of the Netherlands after SARS. So SARS was in 2003. So this was in 2006. And they, what they were trying to do is identify, and I believe there's another paper there that shows you the various mechanisms by which we might produce anti-SARS drugs. But both of these identify this particular receptor that I referred to earlier called the ACE2 receptor, which is on the epithelial cells of the respiratory linings in the alveoli. Mm-hmm. And so with that, they again looked at... So they identified that as the receptor, and then they looked at what it was that would help prevent, and this was SARS. So, you know, essentially the same virus with, you know, obviously some genetic differences, but the same virus we're talking about with COVID-19. So we'll just call it the SARS virus instead of COVID-19. It seems that the way that it prevented it from attaching was to downregulate those ACE2 receptors. And the way that it does that is by upregulating or secreting more of a couple of cytokines. In particular, they identified gamma interferon. You guys have probably heard of interferon out there. Yeah. This is a cell-to-cell signal. And another one called interleukin-4. And they also looked at tumor necrosis factor alpha. And to make a long story short, it seems that what happens is those people that are keto adapted, these aren't people, these were green monkeys that they were working with. So a closer model to a human lung for sure. So those keto adapted monkeys produced more of the gamma interferon, which downregulated or decreased the number of these ACE2 receptors, which gave fewer targets for that SARS virus to attach and gave a better outcome. So, So there's a SARS specific one for a slightly different virus in a different species. And then the last bit of evidence is actually from our own research at the BC Cancer Research Lab. This was just a pilot study. So these are people that had been keto adapted. It was open label. I counseled them myself. They were 6 months after the experiments, so they may or may not have kept it. We actually kept a track of how well they stayed with the plan. Mm-hmm. And we looked at their blood. And what we do is we actually draw their blood. We isolate the white blood cells, and then we challenge those blood cells with both a viral and a bacterial challenge. So the bacterial one is E. coli. And the viral one is herpes simplex. Now, the herpes simplex one. So the interesting thing about that is that's the same virus that they used as a challenge in these monkey studies. Mm-hmm. And what we found was a significant difference between the control group of people who were not keto adapted and our small, very small pilot study. There's about a dozen in the study that had been keto adapted, an increased response when challenged. So in other words, their gamma interferon isn't high. The gamma interferon is what makes you feel sick. So when you feel really sick and awful and all that, that's actually the gamma interferon. So remember, I was asking people, do they feel like they're coming down with something and then they don't?
Yeah.
That's the gamma interferon that you're feeling, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why you're feeling that. It's this enhanced immune response to this this viral insult. And so your enhanced immune response is preventing it from getting hold and starting to. So it's part of the innate immune system. So we found, and you'll see that in one of the studies, that this heightened or elevated amount of gamma interferon when challenged in people that are keto adapted. So you put that together with the notion that gamma interferon helps downregulate these ACE2 receptors. And then also that there seems to be, in mice at least, an improved innate immune response to an influenza virus, which is somewhat similar. And that's the very, very, very flimsy hypothetical evidence.
Sure, I can see it, I can see it on the graphs here because I've got the... And I should have got Jack because he's... a grade A maths guy, and I can see it because I think when you pointed it to in low carb Denver the difference between the control and the ketogenic and the difference on that the gamma graph, which if I'm right is it the
it's the second row on the right, And then you can compare that to some of the data in these other studies if people want to go and look at them, and you'll actually see, I think I have one of the slides there too, that the I think it's the triangles on that one, that the gamma interferon absolutely reduces the number of the number of the SARS infected cells.
Sure.
So, that all said, I have to declare the conflict. I've written a book on the therapeutic benefits of ketogenic diets, my book BioDiet, and so the reason I wrote that book is I just want people to have accurate information. And so, in the context of this conversation, I wouldn't want anybody to take it away. As a takeaway, say, ketogenic diet will prevent you from getting this. It's way, way too early to do that. This is just a hypothesis.
Sure.
And we see a few mechanisms by which this works.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd revert back to my original statement is the best way to do it is, wash your hands, stay healthy, stay away from people. And the best way to stay healthy in terms of addressing cardiometabolic disease is a ketogenic diet, because I think it was actually earlier in the talk. You don't have the slides for that, but I think all these chronic diseases, including the ones we mentioned, cardiovascular disease and cancer and diabetes, I think they're all different manifestations of an issue that happens at the mitochondrial level.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially, they're kind of the frenemies within. And if we look after our mitochondria, they will look after us and we'll be healthy and we'll have good resistance to disease, including infectious disease. If we don't look after them, if we eat a bunch of crappy food and we don't exercise, we don't sleep, we get stressed, they get stressed. And when they get stressed, they do crazy things and they release all these chemicals that trigger oncogenes and create this cardiometabolic disease that we then need to take, as you say, tablets or whatever to try and control.
Yeah.
So I'd rather go with that one, but I did want, I think it's fair enough that people should have the actual science because there'll be a lot of muck out there in the Twitterverse and social media about cures. And I just want people, and again, even with my, we never say that the ketogenic diet will cure cancer. It only works as an adjunct with the standard of care.
Yeah.
And this is just emerging evidence at this point.
Yeah. So. And obviously you some of your research is on certain types of cancer as well, which it's
breast cancer. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in fact, one of my elderly neighbors has just been diagnosed, but she's so positive about it. And, we've sort of gone to tell her about, I think she's probably the most healthiest person I know, apart from, age takes over and these things that happen, and it's just one of those things. But we're supporting her. Again, we live on quite a steep hill in North Wales, but we've got a little bit of a WhatsApp community. We self-isolate, but if anybody needs some of our younger, and that will include me, although I'm 50, I'm one of the youngest on the hill, we'll go out for their prescriptions or things. So I think when you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it is more about social help rather than the hoarding mentality. I think that will pass. There's enough food in the world to go around. If any of you guys on the ketogenic diet are looking at food swaps, I've noticed in the supermarket that the people who are carboholics are wiping the shelves clean. But there are literally, I'm not going to tell anybody, that there are foods there that are in abundance that us keto followers can eat. So
yeah, let's not let that one out of the bag.
Yeah.
I was talking to one of the fellows at the conference, the guy who introduced me, actually, Mark, was saying he's from West Virginia. And yep. They hadn't had a case until just a day or so ago. Mm. But he said, there's a fair bit of knowledge about keto diets that they can't get eggs there now because all the keto people have gone out and they scooped up all the, which is on the cover of my book too. So
exactly. Yeah.
My wife went out to pick up some food. So we'd have, just in case we were get locked down for 2 weeks the butcher was busy, but not too busy. She said people were being very civilized, but you can get your butter and we can live on meat, right? If we have
sure.
to, I wouldn't worry too much about stocking up on fresh vegetables, because if push comes to shove, you don't really need those in your diet. I mean, they're nice to have, but this is a global pandemic and kind of an emergency situation. So if we're getting back to more of the blitzkrieg kind of,
yeah.
mentality, then what you want to have is meat and butter and eggs and dairy. Mm-hmm. And if you need to live on that, you don't need a lot of that. You know, you could probably live on a bottle of olive oil for a week if you had to, but if you have that and it doesn't take much space in your freezer or your fridge, I live in a, you know, apartment, so we don't have a very big refrigerator. Sure. And so, you know, you don't have to hoard the stores to get enough food to last for a couple of weeks. And there is no evidence that there's any shortage in the supply chain anywhere for food.
No.
So you don't need to hoard food. People are going a little crazy on toilet paper, which is kind
of
weird.
Because I think that came out of a tweet and people. Probably. Yeah. And there's another product which fails to.
That hand sanitizer.
Hand sanitizer. It's amazing. Some of the reports that's going round that people are selling on eBay for you know, hundreds of pounds for things. But you know, they'll you know, what will be, and I believe in a yin yang sort of philosophy that those type of people they've got it coming in other ways. So we've noticed that we haven't really hoarded, but apart from a week before that tweet or whatever went out on the toilet rolls, we'd just gone to Costco and just got our, you know, spring order anyway. So that was quite handy. And also, I think back to the community, people seem to be so reliant on online shopping and the big supermarkets. I've seen a note, and people are really clubbing together and supporting local businesses, especially our local butcher, our local milkman who delivers dairy and eggs. So I must say a big shout out to those you know, local businesses that are keeping us afloat and keeping spirits up. And I think, you know, back to the beginning of the podcast, find ways of making you happy, because that'll just boost your immune system no end.
Exactly. You know, we should start a little website on the called the Silver Lining about there'll be all kinds of wonderful things that come out of this. People get to know one another. I think humans are at their best when things are at their worst. But the worst humans also come out when things are at their worst. So if we can get past them, and they'll always be around.
Exactly.
We're gonna have some wonderful lessons, and you know, this one is not. It's kind of like an earthquake. You know, this is like a 4 or 5. This isn't a 7 or an 8. Mm-hmm. If we were to get a pandemic influenza virus like H1N1, that has the same fatality rate as that did. Because it's much more easily spread through aerosol as opposed to contact, you know, that could spread just as quickly and be much more fatal. So this is a good test for everybody to see what works and what doesn't work. You know, I like to learn from experience.
Yeah.
Listen, Rob, too, I'd like to point out, if people want a very good, it can be a bit frightening, but it's a very good reference of just for the to follow the epidemic. Johns Hopkins University. And don't forget, Johns has an S on it. People always say John Hopkins, but it's actually two people. So Johns Hopkins University. If you just go Google them with coronavirus, they have a dashboard that I have on my computer that updates pretty much daily, that shows all the regions on the maps and shows. Yeah. And so in the bottom right of that, there's a little map inset that shows the Chinese experience in mainland China and how that's been able to level off now. They haven't really had any new cases in a while. I don't think there's any new cases in Taiwan for a while. So these things, and I think even in South Korea, it's leveled off.
Yeah.
Then there's a yellow one, and the yellow one is the rest of us, which is basically Europe and North America at this point, because we're never going to get accurate data from either Africa or India, because they don't have the testing capability and they don't have the infrastructure. So sadly, now that that's there, we it'll be, you know, decades before we figure out how much it affects people. Probably not decades, but it'll be a while. But that yellow line, what we want to see that do, it's right now it's going up exponentially. It's kind of doing that hockey stick thing, as we say in Canada.
Yep.
But we want to see it start to level off. And when we see it start to level off, then we will be assured that these measures we're doing, the social distancing, the testing, the social isolation, that sort of thing, is having an effect. It ought to. But that's kind of a cumulative line. I eventually we'll be able, hopefully, to tease these out and see how different countries are doing things. Getting back to the U.S., if I might for a while, I'll share my experience there because for a number of reasons, mostly because they were not prepared to test. They didn't have approved test kits. But I think at various levels, let me pause it. There's some people there that are, the healthcare workers on the front lines are fantastic. There are health officials there that are very capable people. The leadership they're getting that goes right to the top, and we know who we're talking about, is a bit confused and giving all kinds of mis and disinformation. And they're almost using this as a bit of a political opportunity to gain attraction, which, you know, I know it's an election year, but this is not,
it's not an issue on which
you know, you don't want to build it on this. So my experience was that they were completely disorganized. I shouldn't say completely. They're very disorganized, unprepared, unaware. And so when I went to Denver Airport, which is why I said if I've been exposed, that's almost surely where I was exposed. I went there to fly home on Sunday. And I arrived and there was a, you know, not obscene lengthy line, but about a 45-minute line to clear the security check. And but they, first of all, they had these reciprocating lines, you know, where you go back and forth, which is the... In the old days, we used to just queue up one behind one another. And that's actually what you want to do, because that way it's only the person in front of you and behind you that you are subjected to. When you do these reciprocating lines, it's almost the way the kidneys work through counter-current exchange mechanism, we call it, is you're actually exposing yourself to the maximum number of people as you go back and forth to wait for these things. So that was the first bit of lunacy I saw, that and there was no health officials there. They're just the usual TSA folks. And then the arrangement of Denver is once you get through that, you go down these two escalators. You can't get up from there. And there are these trains that take you out to the gates. And the, there's two escalators coming down from one side and two from the other into this lower concourse. And as I got onto the escalator, of course, you know, there's people packing on there. So there's, once you're on the escalator, you're going down there. And you're in with, I would estimate, 1,000 people packed into a very small platform that's maybe 50 yards by 20 yards. Shoulder to shoulder and waiting for these trains. It took about 20 minutes. And then you got on the train where you're packed in like sardines because everybody's, and there's nobody monitoring or anything or trying to keep, and then out to your gate. Now, once you're at your gate, it was reasonable. The flight was great. Our airliner, Canada, was good. They were very careful. When I got to Canada, it was like a breath of fresh air. Everything seemed pretty well organized. But there, I just thought you couldn't design a better viral Petri dish to test the effectiveness of human stupidity to transmit virus. I just thought, well, you know, once you're in it, well, like, you're done, right? It doesn't matter at that point. So far so good. I've been home for about 3 days now, and I'll self-isolate for 14 days. And then at that point, I will probably still continue to certainly keep a distance. I mean, here in Canada, they've declared a state of emergency in our city, in our province, and federally. So right now in Vancouver, which if you've been there, it's a beautiful city, but there's no restaurants open. There's no some restaurants that have the capacity to spread people out are still open. But basically, everything except grocery stores and pharmacies are closed. It's almost like a giant 2-week holiday. And they're asking us to hunker down. As I said, the borders are closed. If you leave Canada now, there's no guarantee you'll get back in. So people are staying home. And we finally closed the last border to personal travel, which was the U.S. border just today. And then on top of that, fortunately, our government was wise enough to calm people by ensuring that there would be economic measures that would help, you know, folks like you who are self-employed and people who might be put out of work. So they get the equivalent of employment insurance benefits straight away. It's all going to be done online. So they're creating a lot of liquidity in the markets in the capital markets to allow people to continue to go out and consume and buy the foods they are. And you know, if we all just work together, I love what I'm hearing about your community, help each other out, work together. We have all these amazing tools for communication. We will get through this. And sadly, some people will not. And this, unfortunately, is the unpredictability of life. We're biological organisms. We're not perfect and we're not invincible. So what we have to do is do the best we can to stay healthy and happy.
Exactly. And don't keep your eye off the ball of other, you know, other conditions that people have. Somebody brought to mind, I've got a friend who runs a charity and, you know, 1.3 million men die of prostate cancer a year. You know, and that's a big figure in the scheme of things. And then you've got people with type 2 diabetes, type 1 diabetes, mm-hmm. hypertension, and everything that we've mentioned before in the keto community.
Yeah, and then if you're still smoking, now would be if now isn't a good reason to quit smoking, because smokers absolutely have a worse outcome in these things because it's a respiratory insult. So if you haven't quit smoking yet, now would be a darn good time to do it.
Exactly, because you can't go out and get a packet of cigarettes anyway because you're not allowed. Well, you're not yet anyway.
We might get there.
I know, yeah. So before we close the podcast, what's happening in the future? You know, after all this sort of madness is over and everybody's back to healthiness. Have you got anything lined up in terms of a new book, a tour, more podcasts?
I think probably more podcasts because I'm not going anywhere for a while. I think this is the worst of this will be over by summer. And then we'll be, most things, I had a really full schedule for the next like couple of months and now it's completely open. So yes, I'm going to use that time productively. I'm going to, I may work on a new book. What I would like to look at actually is I'm also a design thinker. I think you and I talked about that off air one time. And there's a lot of aspects of design thinking which actually can be applied to looking at both health and nutrition, but also in communicable disease. So, root cause analysis is mm-hmm. just one example. I've got lots of things to do. I've got lots of projects here, but I can look at the way I live right next to quite a beautiful park. So if I avoid people, I can take walks in the park. And I've been so busy the last couple of years a couple of weeks just of downtime reading books and things. So if you got a good book you want to mention, let me know.
I just do a little bit of research, but I've been reading everything by Dave Asprey, the bulletproof guy, and about longevity, and as well mm-hmm. as his bulletproof thing, but listening to his podcasts and people like Rick Roll and those types of sort of the ones that are up in the charts compared to my little podcast here.
Yeah, well, I think your little podcast is an excellent one. So.
Oh, thanks.
And hey, listen, if you want, I did mention, I think earlier, that my wife and I went into the audio studio last fall. We produced an audio version of the book.
Brilliant.
I am a little concerned because it was successful and we republished print copies 4 times, but they're getting in short supply. And I'm not actually sure that printing books is going to be a priority in the short term. So it is available as an ebook, which is just a file transfer. And then we did this audiobook, which was so much fun. Dale and I read it ourselves, and mm-hmm. Dale Drury is my wife and co-author. And so that's available. I think it's a lot less expensive, but it's, and we did it on all platforms because we actually get less return in terms of transparency. We don't make very much money on the audiobook, but we did want to do it on that lower return basis because that made it available through libraries and schools and so on. So they can order the audiobook. I really like audiobooks too, because you can kind of, go for a walk and listen to something at the same time.
Amazing. I think that's what I might do as well. And
and then we got to do that film.
We've got to do the film. Jack's up for it. Jack's actually got an offer in university, an unconditional one. And he's going to do a film production, but he's got the opportunity to do a 6-month secondment, and one of the places is, of all places, Vancouver.
As I always say, look for the signs in life, right? And it will be provided for you. That sounds like a deal for us then.
I know, yeah, definitely. Well, I'm going to say a big thank you to Dr. Dave Harper.
Thanks.
And we'll no doubt we'll have you again on the Keto Happiness podcast. I'll post all the links, and rather than me sort of creating a PDF, I'll point everybody towards your website and social platforms so they can have a look at the presentation slides that you did in Low Carb Denver. But
biodiet.org is the site. But if you look me up on Facebook, I've actually been doing every Sunday, I've been taking people through the bio diet on a local radio show. Well, it's Western Canada, called the Sunday Night Health Show. And they can actually just look up Sunday Night Health Show and it'll probably pop up on Google. So they can go back and look at previous shows, and I usually come on about half an hour into the show.
Brilliant.
What I've been doing is taking the host and coaching her through the 12 weeks of the bio diet. So we're getting near the end. So it's a little, maybe 10 or 15 minute segment each week.
Amazing. Well, thanks again, Dave. And you're listening to the Keto Happiness Podcast with me, Rob Saunders. And we'll see you all next time. Thank you.